Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience. Hello, welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Mike Coons, USU's Extension Forestry Specialist. So we are going to be talking trees today, and if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also go online to upr.org and click on the Programs tab to email us a question. Or, as I'm coming into the 21st century, you can tweet us questions with hashtag AUGarden. So we'll see what happens. If anybody wants to Twitter a question, it's hashtag AUGarden. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I just love this time of year. I don't know if it's just because I go out and I see things starting to bud forth. As I looked out the window this morning, I could see my Fort McNair. I forgot what the name of the tree is. It's a horse chestnut.
Oh.
And it has the big pink blossoms on it. It just looks so pretty, and it's going to have a ton of blossoms on it. Keep my fingers crossed this year. And out front, I've got a couple of beech trees. I've got my Himalayan white pine. But for me, what I love is that I've got diversity, and I only have one maple, and it was planted before I moved in, and I didn't want to take it out because it provided the shade.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have 7 Norway maples, which kind of dominates things. 6 of them are at the curb. I live on a corner lot. But
They used as a street tree.
And then one that's just in the middle of the front yard, and it's a better one. But Norway maple's definitely way overplanted and actually is becoming a little bit of a weed. And certainly in the northeastern U.S., people can't believe we allow the planting or promote the planting of Norway maple out here because it is such a weed back there.
Because it just springs up on its own so well.
Yeah, and
well, I see that here, too.
It does in your neighborhood.
Because I've got them. They just keep coming up.
Well, they're also in Logan Canyon and maybe in other canyons. I'm not sure. But I also have 4, I think, other maples, Japanese maples, each one a different variety and turning different colors in the fall and different leaf shapes. And those I chose to put in, the Norway maples I inherited.
Well, I thought if I could have done it over again, instead of selecting a Norway maple, I would have put in a Rocky Mountain Big Tooth maple. At least that's more, it's a local tree. And it seems to produce a lot more color than my Norway does. I just get some muted yellows out of that one. So
yeah, the best you get from a Norway maple is bright yellow, and that's sometimes. There's just, even if Norway maple wasn't becoming a little bit of a weed, it doesn't have that much to recommend it, you know.
Why is it here? Why are we finding them in the stores?
In the second part of what you asked, you may have answered the first part. We're finding them in the stores, so we buy them. But the more people ask for other trees in the stores, then the more we'll start seeing other things. And the big box stores tend to carry what a buyer makes available for that store, may or may not have anything to do with what is good for the area. Some seem to and some don't seem to. I've seen loblolly pine in stores here in Utah.
I take it they don't grow very well here.
Well, loblolly pines are deep south, and both of the big box home construction type stores we have are headquartered in the deep south.
Ah.
So there may be something to that.
But you can grow a bald cypress.
Can grow bald cypress, and that's a deep south tree from about southeast Missouri, south and east to Florida.
So how does that work? You get a tree that usually you would see in a swamp or think of being in a swamp growing in Utah?
Yeah, that's just kind of freakish. It's, you can't really explain why bald cypress would do well here. And the only thing it doesn't do real well with is really high pH soils.
Oh, okay. So.
And we have high pH, but sometimes we have really high pH, and then they'll show iron chlorosis.
So maybe along the benches, but maybe not so much out in the West Desert.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, in the same family, though, is giant sequoia. And so that tells you something, maybe, because giant sequoia also is a species that you would think wouldn't do well here if you see it where it grows in nature in California. But both of those species seem to be good species for moving around and putting in places you wouldn't think they would do well.
Now, let's back up and talk more about the maple family, because there are several different trees that are within that family. So we talked about the Norway maple, but there's also another variety of tree that's more pyramidal shaped that you see around here a ton. And I'm forgetting the name of it. It's a, I can't remember.
A maple?
Yeah, it's a type of maple. It's kind of a pyramidal shape. It's got really great smelling flowers on it. And maybe I've always thought it was in the maple family.
Well, no, you're thinking of a linden.
Yeah, is that not in the maple family?
No.
Oh, okay. So what is a linden maple when I hear people refer to a linden maple?
I've never heard that term.
Okay, so.
Lindens are the same as basswoods.
Okay.
And in Europe, they call them lime trees, L-I-M-E. I don't know why. And they're often pyramidal. The cultivars we grow are either little leaf linden, little leaf European linden, and then the other one tends to be a cultivar of American linden called Redmond that also has a pyramidal shape. Both of those, you know, they're okay trees. They have wonderful smelling flowers. You can steep the flowers, the whole flower inflorescence with the bract and the flowers in water and make a kind of a tea out of it.
My big complaint about those, the aphids love them.
Yeah, aphids
do. You can't
park
a car underneath them, otherwise you're going to have sticky, and then when it dries, hard sap on top of your car.
Yeah, in August, if you look up from under a linden tree and catch the sun, you'll see this stuff just raining down.
The honeydew.
And it's honeydew, which is, I'll say nicely, has been processed through an aphid, and it's sugar water, really, and it'll coat your grass and coat anything underneath it. I always, if I, my lindens don't get bad aphids every year. I have both an American linden and a European linden, and when they get aphids pretty bad and it's starting to show honeydew on the grass underneath, I take a nozzle on my hose and turn it up to full pressure and just take 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and hose down each tree, hitting as much of the foliage as possible. And I got that from Diane Alston, and you're just knocking as many of the aphids off as possible and knocking the population down. And I guess aphids don't really have a way to get back where they want to be, up in the crown of the tree. So I think they're born there, you know, or hatched there. And so you're knocking them off. And you also clean some of the honeydew off when you do that. And it seems to knock the population down enough that then you can live with it the rest of the summer. I just do it once.
Oh, just the one time?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it makes it a little easier for picnicking, because sometimes you just forget, and then you're sitting there and you can actually feel something dripping into your hair or whatever. So.
Yeah, there is a bit. Speaking of diversity, though, there is a better linden than either of those for our conditions, and that's silver linden, Tilia tomentosa. And tomentose in botanical term means hairy. And the bottoms of the leaves are bright white, just covered with white hairs. And then the tops of the leaves are really dark green. And it seems to maybe get less aphids. I don't know if they don't like to feed like through that hairy coating because it coats the leaf. You can't see anything but the hair on the bottom. And that seems to be a good alternative to those.
So what about, we've talked about a ginkgo before in the past.
Ginkgos are really good. And I was looking at ginkgos, when was that? This weekend. And they need to be planted more. As you indicated, it's a kind of a, I think you said prehistoric. It's a tree from China, maybe Japan, but I know China. It's a little hard to say where it's from, though, because it was totally gone from nature, no longer growing in nature. It may have come back into nature since, I'm not sure, but it was no longer growing in nature. It was cultivated in temple gardens, and that's the only place it existed.
So it was out of nature, but still grown in those temple gardens. Okay.
Yeah, right. And was then cultivated that way for thousands of years and now is out in the world horticulturally because it's such a fine tree. They turn brilliant yellow in the fall. They don't stay yellow for a long, long time, usually. Sometimes it can be just a few days, but it can be up to a couple of weeks. They're called a maidenhair tree. The leaf kind of flares out because of how the venation on the leaf is.
So it looks like a little fan.
Yeah, almost. Right. Sometimes with two lobes and bright green. They don't seem to have any problems with soil compaction. There's two ginkgos right where everybody walks on the packed ground by the student center here. Any tree that can survive around any university student center is probably a good choice for tough sites. And it can stand air pollution, compacted soils, high pH. Has no insect or disease problems, maybe because the insects and diseases died off when the tree died out in was no longer in nature. And there's a lot of cultivars, so cultivated varieties, different sizes and shapes. You want to get a male, but pretty much no nurseries carry females unless they have one by mistake. The females produce a fruit that smells really bad,
like rotting flesh.
It smells like vomit.
Ah, okay.
And sorry about that. And I've only come across one female ever. And if you had an arboretum, you'd want to have one, but have it back in the corner, you know. But they're really nice trees and do really well. They don't grow fast, but a lot of people say they grow really slow. And there's one in my neighborhood that the house, at the most, this tree is maybe 30 years old. And it's 35 feet tall and, you know, a trunk that's maybe 10 inches in diameter. I don't consider that really slow, you know. I mean, that's not a fast-growing tree, but generally you should stay away from fast-growing trees because they put very little energy into making good, strong wood and protecting themselves from insects and diseases. So you end up buying a lot of headaches when you buy a fast-growing tree.
I have a good friend of mine who had me come over to a home that they had just bought in December to help them identify plants in their yard. And I looked next door, and the neighbor had this big willow tree, and I just whatever you could do to encourage him to take that down and put something else in. I mean, they give you quick shade, but that's about it, because once they get big enough that they're giving you shade, then they start giving you other problems as well.
Yeah, and I'm all for willows and cottonwoods where they belong in kind of natural settings. Sometimes in parks, they can be an appropriate tree, although even then you don't want cottonwoods and willows dominating your city park where you have a picnic grounds or something. You want them over by the stream, out of the way. You don't want them where there's a lot of human targets for broken branches to break off.
Because that's what they do.
Yeah,
they
just
drop.
That's right.
Well, part of what I wanted to talk about today, and we're kind of headed in that direction, is trees that take more like you said, the compacted ground in areas that are high traffic areas. So as we're looking at the ginkgo, is that a good one for a park strip? Some trees, the roots tend to, you know, raise the sidewalk, and they don't want you to plant them in there. And I suppose you need to have a certain width of a park strip anyway to really plant a tree in it.
Yeah, I think if you have a park strip between the sidewalk and a curb and the curb, you should have at least 6 feet and preferably 8 to 10 feet. Some cities used to have that. Logan used to have it in the old part of town. There might even be 12-foot parking strips in the old part of town. but we went to 3-foot and 30-inch and 2-foot parking strips for a while. Now, in any new developments, I think we're going back to wider parking strips. Some other communities in Utah are doing that, too. But ginkgo would be good, but I haven't seen it very often in parking strips. I don't think it heaves roots. London plane tree, or sycamore, people call it, is actually used a lot in parking strips and is less likely to push up the sidewalk, even though it's a tree that grows bigger than little leaf linden. Little leaf lindens will push sidewalks up easily, yet they don't get nearly as big or grow as fast. What else? You'd want a tree that what you want to avoid is really small trees for parking strips. It might seem that you've got a small space, so you want a small tree, but the small tree can never be pruned up to clear the snowplows and the garbage trucks or even parked cars. And then the other side, it can't be pruned up high enough to let people walk under it. So a small crabapple with a, say, an 8-foot wide crown in a 3-foot wide parking strip, the parking strip can handle the roots and the trunk, the ground can, but above ground, that 8-foot wide crown is going to get in the way of everything. And yet the tree may never get over 12 feet high, so you can't really raise the crown up, pruning off those lower branches.
I know when I've seen conifers, like a blue spruce that someone has planted, and it's maybe 6 feet away from the sidewalk. I just think, well, yeah, that'll look nice for maybe 15 years or so, and then
they have to prune it up.
And then they'll have to prune it all the way up. And my preference for conifers like the blue spruce is to leave them branched all the way down. I hate it when they're cut off just because someone wants to be able to mow underneath them. I'm like, well, if you leave it down, the grass won't grow there and you won't have to mow it anyway.
Right. They can look really good pruned if they're really old. They start looking like it's time for losing the lower branches. But normally, yeah, you want that crown to go all the way to the ground.
So what about some other varieties for a parking space? Or, you know,
maples are good depending on the maple.
Let's talk about some natives.
Oaks would be good.
Some natives. So would a Rocky Mountain maple be good for something like that?
Well, we have three native maples in Utah. And what you just called Rocky Mountain maple, I think you mean Big Tooth or Canyon maple. There is a small Rocky Mountain maple that's kind of shrubby. And the Rocky Mountain maple would be too small, but the Big Tooth maple would be fine. Unless you have one of the more shrubby ones, you'd want to prune it into a single stem, probably, if it was in a parking strip.
There's supposed to be a nice specimen of a Big Tooth maple over on the Mendon Bench somewhere on the way up to the Coldwater Trailhead. I don't know how old it is, but it's been there a long time.
Yeah, sometimes they're tree-like and have a central leader. And there is a cultivar of Big Tooth maple, Rocky Mountain Glow. Usually if you have a cultivar, then it's been propagated by grafting, so they know what the genetics of the top of it are, and therefore they'll always have the same general appearance. And Rocky Mountain Glow, the problem with it is it's grafted onto sugar maple rootstocks from the east. Because the wholesaler who grows them can grow sugar maple rootstocks really well. They have known varieties, I suppose, that they use for rootstocks, and they know how to graft onto them really well. So we've got a sugar maple rootstock that is interacting with our soil, and our soil is high pH, and sugar maples really don't like high pH soils. And but then we have our native tree grafted onto it, and it forms a central leader. Unfortunately, it tends not to have very good fall color. That's the main reason to have that tree. So if you buy a big tooth maple, I lean towards buying one where they've grown them from seed, and you're going to have some genetic variability, but you'll at least more likely to have a good fall color.
What about local growers? If you can find someone who's growing them here, like I'm thinking of one that's in South Central Utah where they're growing them. That's probably the best way to go.
Right. I think you'll only find the non-Rocky Mountain glow from local growers. I don't think others are growing it. It could be Lawyer's Nursery in Montana might be growing it, but those are seedlings.
I think it's Wildland Nursery is the one that I'm thinking of in southern Utah. Uh-huh. Well, we have our first caller. We have Barbara in Hiram. Hi, Barbara. How can we help?
Hi. I only want to rake leaves on a tree that I love, and I want to find a beautiful red in the fall tree. So what should it be? I live in Hiram where we've got lots of gravel.
Okay, a good red fall color tree
is,
and this is pure red, it's not orange red, generally, is Zelkova, Z-E-L-K-O-V-A, and Japanese Zelkova is the full common name.
Mm-hmm.
It's from Asia. It takes our pretty much any condition we give it. There are some 3 foot to 4 foot diameter ones at the U of U, and actually one at the Salt Lake County Courthouse grounds on the northeast side of the ground of the building. So they can get big eventually. There are cultivars, so you'd want to investigate which cultivar you might want that'll have the shape and size that you want. But Zelkova comes to mind as a really good one.
And so that sounds like, I mean, I've never even heard of it. So would I have to go online to find it or a mail order type thing?
I've seen it here and there. Certainly there's a number of them planted in Logan and in Cache Valley. I've seen them in Cedar City. I've seen them all around. Hmm. They're not extremely rare. And what I recommend you do if you want something a little unusual is go to a local garden center or nursery and ask them to order it. And they tend to be, if it's a pretty active nursery, they'll tend to be getting stuff in all through the growing season.
Right.
And they can order it and get it in.
Okay, so with a 3 and 4 foot diameter, is that the height of the two then?
Well, the height, it could get, like that 4 foot diameter one I've seen, that might be the size of the one at the Salt Lake County Courthouse, might be the city county building, might be 70 feet high.
Oh, my.
But don't worry. I mean, it took a long time to get 70 feet tall. So I know I wouldn't be around when the tree you plant gets 70 feet tall.
What's the shape of the leaf?
It looks like an elm leaf, if you know what an elm leaf looks like, just kind of an ellipse with teeth on the edges.
Right.
And it gets a fruit, but it's a really tiny little nutlet that you would barely notice. It's like an eighth of an inch or a little bigger.
Wouldn't be a problem at all.
No.
Okay. Interesting. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks, Barbara.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We've reached the halfway point in our program. Up next is the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll have our Mike Coons, USU Extension Forestry Specialist, back for the rest of the half hour, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
In many of the diverse Native American storytelling traditions, the coyote plays the same role over and over, that of the smart, sly trickster. For those who study coyote behavior, this characterization is well-deserved. Coyotes are incredibly adaptable creatures, intelligent, observant, curious, and, well, wily. Their ability to adjust how they live to fit their circumstances can be seen in almost every aspect of the coyote's life. For starters, coyotes will eat just about anything. As omnivores and opportunistic feeders, coyotes might be found hunting creatures as diverse as small mammals, birds, snakes, mule deer fawns, insects, or fish, and also seek out grasses, berries, and seeds. They can hunt alone or in packs, and are not below feasting on carrion, rummaging through your garbage, or raiding the cantaloupe patch. The environments in which coyotes can be found are similarly diverse. While once restricted to the American West, coyotes are now widespread across all of North America and parts of Central America, and can be found in nearly every ecosystem from deserts to forests to urban areas, from Belize to Alaska. Sometimes called song dogs, these social creatures are known for their nighttime solos and choruses. Their scientific name, Canis latrans, literally means barking dog, and their many vocalizations help pack members and families bond and communicate over long distances. Coyotes have strong family ties, especially during spring when puppies are born to monogamous coyote couples. Coyotes are territorial and defend their space vigorously, especially when breeding and denning. Mating occurs from January through February, and after a gestation period of only 60 to 62 days, 3 to 12 pups are born blind and helpless in March or April. Young coyotes are nursed for 4 to 5 weeks, at which point they transition to regurgitated meals brought by both parents. Youngsters tag along on family hunts at 8 weeks old and are able to hunt independently by fall. Interestingly, studies have shown that even coyote breeding is adaptable, a phenomenon called density-dependent reproduction. In areas where coyote populations are stable, females bear lower numbers of pups. But in areas where there is disturbance to the population, for example, through increased predation or hunting, females have larger litters. On average, newborn pups have less than a 50% chance of surviving to adulthood due to threats from disease, predators, and starvation. It therefore makes sense for females to bear more offspring in areas where threats may be even greater. To learn more about coyote adaptability, join the Stokes Nature Center for a tour of the USDA National Wildlife Research Center Predator Research Facility on June 16th. For more information, visit www.logannature.org. Thank you to the Rocky Mountain Power Foundation for supporting the research and development of this Wild About Utah topic. For the Stokes Nature Center and Wild About Utah, this is Andrea Liberator.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. Today we have Mike Coons, who is USU Extension Forestry Specialist, and we're talking trees. So if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can go online to upr.org and click on the Programs tab to find the Access Utah link to send your email question. Or you can now Twitter us, tweet us your questions with hashtag AU Garden, or you can follow us on Twitter at AU underscore Garden. So, Mike, we were talking before the half of the program of different trees to be able to put into the landscape. I do have one question that comes from my 9-year-old son. He wants to know, what's the best tree to put in a treehouse?
An oak.
Okay. So he's not likely to be able to plant a tree and be able to put one in there and enjoy it in his lifetime, at least at our house.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. If you wanted to accomplish that, you'd have to plant a cottonwood.
and then it would only last for a couple of years.
Yeah. And, yeah. But I did tree houses when I was a kid, but I lived on the edge of a farm country in Nebraska, and we would just go from our neighborhood up into these wooded draws that went up into the farmland, and I don't even know what kind of tree we were building our tree houses in back then, but an oak is strong, and lots of oaks have really wide crowns. They may be 60 feet tall and 60 feet wide and have big, strong limbs.
I remember when I was growing up, we had just a regular horse chestnut, and it was a big tree, and mm-hmm. about three-fourths of the way up, so we're talking maybe 35 feet off the ground, we had just a basic platform, and then we would put, we probably not the best thing, but we nailed into the tree 2x4 sections so that we could climb up the tree and get into it, and it was kind of cool. I liked mm-hmm. being able to go there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what putting a tree house does to the tree.
Well, mainly you're wounding it when you, like nails or bolts or whatever that you would use, there are wounds formed. If it's a tree like an oak, it will compartmentalize those wounds. They'll be there, but it kind of puts a barrier around them so that decay can't spread into the rest of the tree. If it's a fast-growing species like a willow or a cottonwood, it doesn't compartmentalize well, and that decay will especially go up and down the trunk or the branch from where you make the wound.
And that's not so good because eventually then if you're trying to climb up the tree, the board you're stepping on will rip out. And...
Yeah, it wouldn't last very long. Yeah, I wouldn't do that with a cottonwood or willow.
Our next caller is Barbara from North Logan. Hi, Barbara. How can we help?
Hi, I'm calling to find out a little bit about a species that we might choose for wildlife and also something that might be smaller and create a barrier for your property. My choice would be Russian olive, but oh boy, mm-hmm. that one's not very well received anymore. But I like Russian olive because of the wildlife value and the leaf color and the twig color is gorgeous.
Yeah, it smells good when it's in blossom.
It's a really pretty tree, but some of the places I've gone to are looking at it as a noxious weed and not selling it.
Right.
So if we don't have access to that one, what do we have that might be nice but also thick and good for wildlife?
There are a lot of possibilities. I'll say about Russian olive, in a couple of counties in eastern Utah, it's actually a legally declared noxious weed, and not only should you not sell it in a nursery, but it shouldn't be planted. And if you have it, you're required to try to control it and get rid of it. But I've also heard years ago that Russian olive fruit is the things that look like small olives aren't as don't have a lot of energy in them. Birds will eat them, but that they don't get a lot out of them. I don't know if that's true or not. But one thing that comes to mind, or really a family that comes to mind, is the rose family, the Rosaceae. And the rose family includes the Prunus genus, which is cherries and choke cherries and plums and apricots and peaches and service berries. And service berry is what I'm thinking about. It's in the rose family. And there are a couple of native ones, Saskatoon service berry and Utah service berry, I think they are.
They're beautiful. I have some of those in my yard, and mm-hmm. I just love that species.
Yeah, and there is a hybrid service berry that tends to be the one that nurseries sell that sometimes is multi-stem, sometimes is maybe been pruned to a single stem, and they have nice flowers. They have great fall color, and if you did them multi-stemmed, you could accomplish that thicker look that you're wanting. In the winter, it won't have a lot of visual blocking because the leaves will be off. But
right. And what's the name of that hybrid?
It's called Amelanchier X grandiflora, I think, and it's I can't remember the name.
Do you know the common name? We had a couple of serviceberry trees here at the station that eventually they got yanked out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love them because the cedar waxwings would fly right up to my window.
Yeah.
And just you could watch them pass the fruit along the branch to the ones behind them, and they were kind of fun. I don't know if they didn't like the pH of the soil or exactly what, but eventually the branches started dying out.
Yeah. One thing about the rose family is there are some diseases that tend to get in that family, and Prunus in particular, Prunus genus, like fire blight.
Even into the natives?
I haven't seen it in those natives.
Okay.
And I'm implying that those native serviceberries are in the Prunus genus. They're not. They're a different genus.
Oh, okay.
But, that hybrid one has really great fall color and often is pruned to a single stem. That can be a good one.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara.
All right. Thanks for your call. You're listening to Access Utah. Mike Coons is the USU Extension Forestry Specialist, and we're taking your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. And I'm just checking the email question. So going back to something we were talking about earlier about the aphids, he said, isn't frass the word for aphid, or is that for a matter of any insect droppings?
No, frass is waste produced. Usually I think of it in terms of borers. So they bore in, they chew up the wood, and what they leave behind them, which may be some ground up wood and waste from the insect, that would be called frass.
Okay. And we have our next caller. We have actually a couple of people. Bettina from Springdale. And hi, Bettina. How can we help?
Oh.
Okay. Looks like we lost Bettina. So our next caller. Oh, line two. Okay. Who we got on line two?
Hello?
I hear a hello.
And in the process of dropping line one, I just dropped line two. I'm sorry. So try back in again. 800-826-1495. Looking at the different trees that we have in our landscape then, I purchased one with your recommendation. I gave it to my mom. And it is a cultivar of dogwood, Acusa dogwood. Uh-huh. And it actually does grow here. Our problem, we're finding out, the deer like it.
Mm.
So they keep nibbling the thing to death. And then it starts coming back.
Yeah, deer are an issue in much of Utah, and I looked into it last year because my two magnolias that I have near each other, deer come right between them, and just about the time the blooms are going to open, they eat the flower buds off. The trees are starting to get high enough, they can't reach the top now, but it looks pretty weird. And I looked into it, and research has shown that the main repellents that work are based on eggs, and in particular putrid eggs. But if you don't
it repels everything.
If you don't have putrid eggs, I just put three eggs in a blender with maybe a quart of water and a little bit of dish soap and blended them, cracked them out of the shells, and then I sprayed that on the magnolias last year, and it seemed to help. It seemed like I didn't get any deer feeding last year. I didn't do it this year, and it seems like I lost some of the buds on the sides again. So, but there are commercial repellents. At least some of them are based on eggs like that.
I've heard of one called This One Works. That's kind of a latex, I think, you can spray it on. I have no idea what's in it, but it works on your tulips. So maybe it would work on it. Once your tree gets big, though, it would be quite a lot of work to spray it all the time.
Yeah, but if it's big enough, you're probably not needing to spray it anyway.
Okay, so we've got Bettina back on the line in Springdale. Hi, how can we help?
Yes, I was wondering to talk about bee plants and what are good crops for bee plants in the area. I watched a documentary called Vanishing Bees, and it was talking about the problem with the systemic pesticides and hive collapse. And they basically said that kind of the local beekeeping situation is probably the best at this time to kind of help renew that, to strengthen the hives.
Uh-huh. I don't know a lot about bees. I think they tend to move hives around and follow crops in places where it's important to get pollination for the crop.
As far as a tree, what trees have blossoms that would attract?
Well, it's going to be any of the, again, that rose family, the prunus and the amelanchier, the serviceberries, and the those big showy flowers. You can kind of assume that if a tree has a large showy flower, it's showy because it's trying to attract pollinators, and it's either going to be bees, or some are try to attract hummingbirds, and then some are insect pollinated. Well, other than bees, So the rose family in general, the plums and peaches and serviceberries and chokecherries and all those are going to be good.
Now, I do have to say, I saw a lot of bees, a lot of insects in the serviceberry trees that we had outside of our building here. Yeah. So.
Oh, okay. Well, they did have to bring in hives from Australia the last couple of years to pollinate the California almond trees.
Yeah, I had heard about that.
Yeah.
And almonds are in the rose family, too.
Yeah.
And that would explain why I'm paying $5 to $6 a pound for almonds.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that would explain it. Well, that's a great documentary, The Vanishing Bees. So I recommend it to people to get informed about what's going on in that direction.
Great. Thank you, Bettina.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. And we have our next caller. We have our third Barbara of the day, and this one is in Logan. Hi, Barbara. How can we help?
Hi. I was calling because I have a rather large backyard. It's almost an acre, and it's very, very long, kind of narrow, and it's just empty. We just bought the house about 2 years ago, and I haven't planted any trees in it yet, but we have a really large linden tree right near the house. And then at the far end of the lot, we have a variety of fruit trees. We have apricot, pear, two different kinds of apple, a plum, kind of in a row along the back. But I wanted to kind of plant some more trees in the yard, and I was wondering about how far apart you should space trees when you plant them and how far from the property line you should put them. So maybe how many trees I could kind of put. I would love to have kind of a shady backyard eventually once they all mature.
Mm-hmm. Good questions.
I would tend to group your trees, and well, if you want the whole area to be treed and shaded, just cover it. But if you want some sun, some shade, putting groupings of two or three trees can be good, and then...
So how tight would those groupings be, though?
Well, the groupings can be very tight. Somebody, I have a article on my website that's something like growing a forest for your trees, and tried to make the point that trees usually are from forests naturally, and that's what they're used to, and so we should try to make little groupings instead of having individual lollipop trees out in the middle of the yard.
So would you have a grouping of the same type? Or?
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask.
It could be. And three of them might be good, and you could even put them 6 feet apart in a kind of a triangle.
So for you, that's close. 6 feet is about as close as you want to get.
Six feet is really close for a big tree, but they'll have a third of the sky,
yeah.
each of them, and they will compete with one another, and they'll kind of self-shade on the inside of that grouping. But they'll have plenty of sun on the outside, and you could put them 6 feet apart, you could put them 12 feet apart. The point is to have a group and then mulch around them. Don't try to grow grass under them, and then have your grass in other areas where you don't grow trees. So have little openings where you're going to have grass, and then have mulched beds where you're going to grow groupings of trees. Try to match maybe similar size. Although I've got a large Austrian pine in my front yard, and I've got a blue spruce that has seeded in on its own, growing under the crown of the Austrian pine, and I've got a European beech, one that tends to spread and stay low, that's growing slowly up through the crown of the Austrian pine, because I know that beech is shade tolerant, so I can put it under the pine and it'll do fine. So I like groupings like that, and they don't have to be the same species. You just have to know what the characteristics of them are and make sure they match, fit the location you're going to put
in. So you're not going to put a serviceberry with a conifer that's going to eventually completely shade it out?
Well,
is that what you mean?
But there's a downy serviceberry, which is okay. native to the Midwest and the eastern U.S., that is half of that hybrid I talked about. It's one half of the cross that has some shade tolerance. So serviceberries can be snuck in underneath something else sometimes. I doubt if our two native serviceberries are very shade tolerant, but that downy serviceberry is. The worst that happens is whatever you put too near something else grows slow and maybe eventually fades away, but you might enjoy it for a few years. Dogwoods, some dogwoods are fairly shade tolerant, and redbuds as well.
So have some fun with it.
Great, thank you. And did you say that you have some varieties listed on your website?
Yeah, I was going to say the extension website, it's forestry.usu.edu.
Yeah, that's the Forestry Extension website. And then there's the tree browser, which is treebrowser.org. And that has about 240 tree species that you can select characteristics and narrow the list down to just the ones you want. And then
Great. It
has photographs.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Great.
Thanks
for your call, Barbara.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, this is actually really kind of a cool website because you can subscribe to Utah Forest News. There's a link to the tree browser, tree identification, trees in cities and towns. I mean, there's quite a bit here for people to look at. And again, that's forestry.usu.edu. And
it also has a link to our Facebook page where we encourage people to send in cool pictures of trees or stories. And a YouTube channel where we've put our videos and conference recordings and things like that.
Because you say you've got a grant and you're preparing a site?
A new thing, yeah. Work is supposed to start on it in May, and it may take about a year to do. It's going to be called the Virtual Arboretum. And it's pretty unique. I've found only one thing like it It's in San Francisco, but you'll be able to nominate a tree to this arboretum, like the tree in your front yard or your favorite tree in town, and measure it and get the location of it, take photos of it, and then enter it on a website, either from your smartphone or just on a computer. And the data will be there, and there will be a map, and it'll show the location of the tree, and you click on that, and up will come your pictures and the description of the tree. And it's going to be kind of like Yelp for trees or Urban Spoon, which is a restaurant website for trees.
So if I want to know, okay, does this tree grow anywhere around me so I can take a look at it,
right.
You could just type it in and get the location and go and take a look at it?
That'd be the point. Yeah.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
Especially for less common trees. But we'll get all the – champion trees, the biggest in the state. We'll get them on there. We'll get historic trees. The state keeps a register of heritage trees, and we'll put those in there. But we hope that maybe a school teacher might take their fifth grade and do all the trees in a block near the school, and we'll start getting more and more trees in there. The hardest part at first is going to be having an empty website with nothing to look at, and we'll need people to be putting trees on the website.
So but you'll start with the champions, and then people add theirs as
we'll
it goes
get
along.
A couple hundred trees on just to get the ball rolling.
Now, is this meant to be just for Utah or meant to be for the whole country?
I don't know yet. I don't know what our limits are going to be in terms of the server that it'll be sitting on, and but I'm told that we can handle a lot, so maybe we might go
like
regional
Intermountain
at
West.
Least, yeah. And, but I could see it being useful nationally. Somebody else will have to pay for that.
So will there be a map so that if you type it in, all of a sudden you can see the distribution of
right.
where they are? Okay.
Yeah. It'll be a Google map that we'll use, and you'll be able to zoom in or zoom out, see all the trees in the state, or see just the ones in your area.
Then I could go see that giant sequoia
in
southern Utah that you
That'll
just showed me a picture
there.
Of.
Yeah.
So, and how tall is that tree now?
107 feet tall.
And it seems to be doing just fine.
Yeah. I went with a friend and we measured it. 107 feet tall. I think it was about 52 inches in diameter. It's on my Facebook page.
That's a big
the
tree.
Measurements. And about 30 feet across the crown. It's kind of narrow. But it's just sitting in the Pine Valley Mountains north of St. George. Nobody's taking care of it, and
it seems
just
to be
doing
just
fine.
On its own, even with the droughts and things that they've been having. So, I mean, that's a good indication it might be one to put in your yard. Of course, 50 years down the road, the neighbors may not like it as much, but...
Don't worry about that.
You're listening to Access Utah. Thank you for joining us on the program. We've had with us Mike Coons, who is the USU Forestry Extension Specialist, and we'll have him back in again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Your meals with some fresh-from-the-garden fruit. It's easier than you think to grow your own apples, plums, and berries. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Start by throwing out your old visions of an apple orchard or patch of strawberries. Instead, look for creative ways to incorporate these edibles into your landscape. Substitute disease-resistant tree fruits suited to your climate and landscape design for more traditional ornamental trees. The flowers, fruit, and often fall color will provide seasonal beauty. Use shrub-type fruits as hedges, dividers, and backdrops for other gardens throughout your landscape. Just be sure to leave enough space around the plantings for maintaining the plants and harvesting their fruit. Grow strawberries as ground covers throughout your yard. You'll harvest an abundance of fruit from minimal space. Plus, the white flowers, tasty red berries, and beautiful fall color will brighten up the landscape at your feet. For those with limited space, consider growing fruit in a pot. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.